40 years ago tomorrow, three members of the Miami Show Band were gunned down in cold blood by the UVF. Four decades on, and an appeal is being launched by one of the survivors to find the couple who helped save his life. Des Lee was shot but survived by playing dead. I've been speaking to him. He began by telling me what happened that night.
We were actually performing in a ballroom in Banbridge called The Castle. Now, we did what we always do. All the gigs after the show, we would sit down with the punters, sign autographs, have a chat and all that sort of thing. We then got into our minibus. We had a road manager who would take all our gear around the country for us, and we had our own personal minibus. We got onto the minibus after the show and we proceeded to Dublin, and we were stopped at a roadblock. Now, we'd been used to stop at many, many roadblocks throughout our career travelling around Ireland, and we thought nothing of it. This is just a normal roadblock. Check us and check our van, whatever, whatever. And we were lined up against the ditch. And as I say...
So they asked you to get out?
They asked us to get out of the van.
And did you know at that stage?
No, Stephen. As far as I was concerned, this was just a normal roadblock. They lined us up, started
asking... What were they dressed as?
They were dressed in uniforms, military uniforms. And they asked us the usual questions, age, date of birth, name, where you're living, etc. So we thought nothing of it. I asked, could I go to the van and take my saxophone out and put it on the road to let them see that it was a saxophone? They agreed. I went, got the saxophone, put it out on the road, opened it up and showed it to them. Now, I was to the left. I would have been third in the line facing the ditch. But what happened was when I took the saxophone out, instead of actually going to where I was originally in the line, I stayed at the end of the line. And the next thing was there was a massive explosion and that blew me into the ditch. And I lay face down. I remember watching many, many Vietnam War movies where the GIs would lie face down, hold your breath for as long as you can. And there was just pandemonium, gunfire, screaming, shouting, people running. It was horrendous.
Do you remember what was screamed? Do you remember? I just wonder how the brain copes with that type of thing. Do you remember finite detail?
Well, not really. You know, as I say, I didn't know exactly what was going on at that particular moment in time.
You were pretending to be dead.
I was pretending to be dead, yeah. I held my breath as long as I could. And what actually happened was, because the minibus had exploded, they were putting a 10-pound bomb in the van. That exploded, blew me into the ditch, and the ditch then set fire. As the fire got closer to me, I started calling out Fran, Bran and Tony, got no response. Then I called out Stephen Travers, and Stephen was moaning at that time. And I explained to Stephen that I'm going into Newry to get help. I had to get up and run because the fire came so close to my body that I realised if I didn't get out of there, I was going to be burnt.
And did you realise that the others were dead by that time?
No, I didn't, to be honest with you. I called their name out. I thought they might have been doing the same as me, holding their breath, you know, staying calm. But it was absolutely awful.
Did you see them when you stood up?
Yes, I saw them land down, but I didn't realise at that stage that they were actually dead.
And looking back now, when you remember seeing them, mm-hmm. You now know that they were lying there dead.
Correct, yes.
Your friends.
Yeah. My brothers.
Does that memory traumatise you?
I live with it every day, Stephen. You know, I travel on that road quite a lot. And I stop, say a few prayers. When I'm approaching Buskell, I turn the radio off and I say my prayers and look up to the sky and remember the lads. It's a day I'll never forget. I live with it every day because in my apartment, I have photographs of the lads. So, and, you know, I'm just delighted with the way things have panned out recently. We've just had the bridge in Bray renamed Fran O'Toole Bridge over the River Dargle, which is fantastic.
So amazing.
Yeah. And also, outside Fran's house, there's now a blue plaque. Now, that's the house that he was born in Bray. And I used to do all the songwriting there in that house with Fran. I wrote his number one for him.
There are tears in your eyes, Des.
Yeah.
Tell me why.
It's just a very emotional time to be going through. You know, I'm delighted that I got, that Fran got that bridge after 40 years. He deserves it for what he's gone through. And we've also got the monument now in Dublin in Parnell Square. And on Saturday the 1st of August, we're having a wreath-laying ceremony in Parnell Square. The police in the Republic are blocking off the whole square for 1 hour so we can...
It was the callousness with which the UVF conducted this, wasn't it?
Mm. You know, the thing about it is, these were three lovely, lovely guys who were purely musicians. And during that awful time in Northern Ireland, all we were doing was going out to put a smile on the people's faces for 2 hours at every show we did. That's all we... And no matter what colour, no matter what creed, it didn't matter. We were there to give them a good time.
So let's go back to that moment where you're pretending to be dead and the fire is in the ditch. So if you don't move, you're going to be burned alive.
Mm-hmm.
So you get up and you're trying to get away. Where do you walk to? Is it dark around you? Is it presumably...
No, it was very bright because the actual fire had lit up the whole field, basically, Stephen. So I ran up the ditch. I remember saying to my friends afterwards, if I had been in a running competition for Ireland, I would have got a gold medal. I ran up so fast. I got onto the main road. There was a truck with a trailer on it. And I asked the driver to take me into Newry to the police station.
Were you injured at this time?
I had shrapnel in my leg. That's all I had. And I asked him to take me into Newry. He refused to take me in. And then a young couple came along.
What did he say?
He didn't say a lot now, to be honest. He thought I might have been part of this whole problem.
Okay.
And he wouldn't even let me get on the trailer on the back, never mind getting into his cab. But a young couple came along, who I'm still looking forward to this day. I want to find out, could I meet up with them again and thank them for everything they'd done for me.
What did they do?
They took me into Newry Police Station. I was very wary at that stage of everything that was going on around me. I had my hand on the door handle in case they weren't going into Newry to jump out of the car. But thank God they did take me into Newry Police Station.
Can you remember much about them?
They were just a very young couple, boy and girl. And as I say, I would love to meet up with them again. And I would love to also find a part of my saxophone. Yeah, my saxophone, I never saw it again.
I wonder where it went.
Someone got it.
Well, exactly.
Someone got it. I'd love to just even have a piece of it. Not necessarily the whole saxophone, if I could have a piece of it for the memory.
How special would that be to you to recover that?
Extremely. Extremely. That's what saved my life. I'm actually writing a book at the moment, Stephen, and it's called My Saxophone Saved My Life, which it did. Because if I had gone to where I was in the line, I wouldn't be sitting here today.
So someone lifted it. You would have thought the police would have lifted it as evidence later.
That's what I would have thought now, yeah, to be honest with
clearly
you.
Clearly not.
The police didn't approach me about it, you know, and tell me we have your saxophone, because obviously when the explosion took place, there was obviously a lot of instruments lying around.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that maybe the police would have picked those up.
And you've asked them and they didn't pick any up?
No. But I'm hoping that someone maybe out of the public out there might know where it is.
My goodness, wouldn't that be incredible?
Fantastic.
Absolutely incredible if you were able to do that. And you just never know. You never know who's listening to us.
Yeah. Yep.
Including that young couple who, you know, we don't need to describe them or any of that malarkey because if they were there, if they were the couple that picked you up, they'll know exactly who they were.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to meet them.
Did they say anything to you in the car?
No, they didn't, because I think they were pretty shocked with what they saw. They came on the scene and obviously it was a horrendous scene for anybody to see. And they didn't say a lot, to be honest with you.
You get to the police station.
I got to the police station, yeah. And I remember running in and screaming and shouting. And it was a police lady on duty that particular night. And I never smoked a cigarette in my life, and I saw she was smoking and I asked her for a cigarette. And that was me smoking for the first time in my life. And I must have smoked, I went on to smoking about 60 cigarettes a day for a few years.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. What was it like trying to rebuild your life after that death, when you find out that your friends had been brutally murdered?
It was very difficult, Stephen. We reformed in Miami, and we actually went back and did our first gig in Sea Point, which was our last gig before the massacre. And we went back to Sea Point in Galway. And I remember that night, I didn't enjoy it because Fran, in particular, was a very close friend of mine. We were songwriting partners. Fran was actually due 12 weeks after he was massacred. He was due to go to Las Vegas for a music convention to be launched as a solo entertainer, and I was to become the lead singer of the band. That was all the plans that were made. Now, Fran was an absolutely incredibly talented young man, extremely good looking, and a brilliant keyboard player and a brilliant singer. In particular, he was really into soul music, Wilson Pickett and all that sort of stuff. And me being his songwriting partner, I wrote his album with him, which is called Reflections of Fran O'Toole. And I wrote his number one single, which is called Love Is. So I was absolutely delighted with all this that was planned because I saw myself as a songwriting partner with Fran. I believe that he would have made a world star. He had everything, the looks, the voice, everything.
How old was he when they killed him?
25 years of age. Yeah. He had the world at his feet.
And what happens then over the 40 years since that we're talking about? You know, do you get flashbacks? Do you get periods of anger? Or have you been able to contain it?
I've been able to contain it. There's no point in getting anger. You know, I went through a very bad period for about 5 years where I had to have a lot of treatment for trauma and flashbacks and all that type of thing. So, but what actually happened was when we put the Miami back on the road, as I say, I was expecting to see Fran, Bran and Tony on the stage with all due respects to the other musicians. And it just wasn't there. And the feeling for me wasn't the same as the original band. And I decided to leave after a period of about 9 months. And I decided, because I wasn't able to go and perform in my home of Belfast, I had been threatened in the court case in Belfast.
Had you?
Yes, I was threatened with my life. And I couldn't settle in Ireland, and I decided I wanted to leave the country for the sake of my wife and my children. And I decided to emigrate to South Africa because my sister was already living there and she told me how nice a country it was. So I formed a band and I took the band out to South Africa to do the Holiday Inn circuit. That was to get away from all, everything that happened in the past, and I wanted to rebuild my life as such.
Hard thing to do, this.
Very, very hard. Leaving your family.
Yeah. How did you do that?
Yeah. Leaving your family, leaving your friends, wasn't easy, but for the sake of my wife and children, I had to do it.
You know, it's when I see the pain in your eyes, it's when I see the pain that's still here 40 years later, it reminds me of what these brutal thugs, paramilitaries, reminds me that the pain on both sides that they've caused in this community.
Yeah.
You know, and they even attempt to call themselves soldiers.
Yes.
These thugs.
Mm. Well,
cards.
These were three extremely talented young men. And as I said to you earlier, all they were doing was putting a smile on the face of the public for 2 hours, travelling around Ireland. And that's all they were doing. They were totally innocent guys. And it's scandalous that this happened to them.
What you are doing to commemorate, Des, the 40th anniversary, you're inviting the public to pay their respects at the site where the shootings happened.
That's correct. We're actually having, Stephen, we're having two wreath-laying ceremonies. On Saturday the 1st, we're actually doing one at the Monument in Parnell Square in Dublin at 2 o'clock. And the following day in Buskill, were doing another wreath-laying ceremony at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. My aim now is, now in the Republic of Ireland, we have the monument in Parnell Square. We now have Fran with the bridge in his home with a plaque. I now want to get something done in Belfast. I want to see a monument in Belfast.
And have you approached councillors or politicians?
We're working on it right now. I definitely, that's my aim. I have to see that before I die.
Well, Des, stay across it with us and let us know how you're getting on when you talk to
Stephen.
Elected representatives. And the commemoration will take place Sunday, the 2nd of August it is, isn't it?
That's correct.
At 2:30.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Thanks for coming in, Des.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, your listeners, too.
Well, that's a very emotional interview from Des there. Gary Lee, who is Des's son, has contacted the programme during that, all the way from the United States. Gary, where are you in the States?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
I know you're deeply upset.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, but I'd like to thank you for giving my dad the opportunity to speak his mind. It still affects us every day. We think about it all the time. But I just wanted to thank you. And I had to reach out and thank you for allowing him to speak his mind.
Tell us how it affects you, Des. It's Gary.
I can't even explain what it's done to our lives. I think you heard my father. We had to leave our own country. We had to pick up and leave because we got death threats all the time. Yeah.
Can you remember that as a young boy?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah. It's affected my life a lot. Yeah.
Tell me what you remember.
I remember, and my dad will probably kill me for saying this. I remember when it happened, I was 3.5 years old, and we had to believe they were all dead for a couple of days. So for the first 2 days after it, because he was in the police station giving the report, the stories that we got were everyone was dead, right? So we had to believe that he was dead for a couple of days. And then all of a sudden, the police car pitches up with, and he's back at the house. You know, we thought he was dead. So, yeah, it was a tough time.
And then, can you tell me about the death threats, what your understanding is of what happened?
Yeah, sure. We'd pick, you know, the phone would ring and we'd pick up the phone and they'd be like, we're going to kill you. We're going to destroy you. And so as my dad told you, we just decided it wasn't safe for us anymore. So we picked up everything and we moved to South Africa. It was, yeah. I know.
And obviously that, you know, because your dad's eyes did well up in the studio when he remembered that, because, you know, that was...
Oh, I'm sure he teared up and I'm sure he looked horrible, yeah.
Because that's, you know, he's leaving his family, he's leaving his friends, he's leaving his environment.
We had to leave everyone, yeah. We left everyone, we packed up, we packed a suitcase and we left. Yeah. I mean, that's what happened, yeah.
Obviously a life-changing moment, Gary.
Yeah, absolutely, Stephen. Absolutely. But it's never got better, and now we try and fight it in the legal system. And we know about collusion. It's been proved in the courts, and then we try and make them do the right thing, and they won't do it. You know, every time my dad's lawyer goes to England to get the documents, they say, oh, we lost them. Oh, sorry, we lost that document. We don't know where it is.
So you believe that there was security force involvement in the murders of your father's friends?
Absolutely, yes. It's proven. This is not even up for conjecture or conversation anymore. The Jackal was involved. Robert Jackson did it. And it's, we know the collusion was there. We just want him to, you know what, my dad doesn't even want money. He just wants them to say sorry. That's all we want.
Do you think
all our family wants is sorry?
Do you think the truth will ever come out, Gary?
No, I don't believe it will. I wish it would, because the amount of pain that we go through on every day, that we think about this every day. There's not a day that goes by that we don't feel something from this. It doesn't matter that it's 40 years ago. We feel this pain every day, right? No, sadly, I don't think the truth will ever come out.
Have a listen, Gary, to Gabby and Yuri.
Okay.
Morning, Gabby.
Stephen, good morning.
You were there on the morning
lorry,
of...
I was a young lorry driver then, Stephen. And we left Yuri in a group because at that time... There were very uncertain times and there wasn't a lot of traffic on the road and that the morning, Stephen. Our job was to take tomatoes from the Irish Republic to the fruit market in Belfast. And there was the McGoverns had a lorry and Colin Boyle had a lorry and I worked with the Phillipses and they were the three lorries. But I drove the fourth lorry which brought fruit back to Newry for the shops. And we were leaving Newry, and the army stopped us. This UDR depot as you leave Newry, and they spoke to us individually because you had to show your license going over the ramps. And the soldier said to me, when you get out to the dual carriageway, which was actually the first dual carriageway leaving Newry in them days, he told us to keep hard over to the left that a group of IRA men had blown themselves up. But it was very, very evident, Stephen, when we got out the road. And I seen the instruments and all.
It's very evident that was not true.
Yeah, very evident. And when we got to Belfast, we were actually the first ones really to talk about it in the market because everybody was running around waiting on the 7 o'clock news coming from Radio Ulster to confirm what we thought we'd seen, which was some sort of a massacre, but we didn't know nothing. And the firemen at the scene, there were several fire tenders and a lot of police, and they're just telling us to keep moving on. And I spoke to Stephen Travers about this at Lance one night, and I think it would be very important that anybody in Newry that ever played in a group or a show band make a point of being there on Sunday, and I'm delighted to hear they're coming to Busker Hill because I think it's about time that Newry paid homage to a group of people who really were offensive to nobody, and most of us danced the Miami show band, and most of us had seen Fran O'Toole at some stage, and you know, I just feel so sorry for Des and his son there.
Okay.
That has been carpeted for so long, you know.
Okay, Gabby, thank you.
I want to say, Gabby, thank you. Thank you so much for what you said. I really appreciate it.
And your dad's desperate, Gary, to find a saxophone. Desperate. I wonder where it went.
I know. I didn't. You know what? I didn't even know that until tonight. Until I listened to your show. Because he told me to listen in last night, and then it didn't come on. And then I was listening, and then he called me today, and he said, oh, sorry, it was delayed by a day. So I was listening, and I had no idea that he's so desperate to find the saxophone.
Well, wouldn't it be great if through this program,
if the people
of Northern Ireland could help find it? It must.
Yeah.
You know, it went somewhere. It went somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
From that crime scene.
You got to remember that they planted the bomb in that saxophone case. So the bomb actually went off in that saxophone case. So there's probably very little left of that saxophone. But yes, and that's why he said if you could find any piece of it, he'd be happy.
Yeah.
Because it will just be pieces.
You're another reminder, Gary, of the pain and the devastation that's still out there. On this occasion, 40 years later.
Yeah, it doesn't get any better, my friend. It doesn't get any better.
Thank you for talking to us today.